Hello and welcome to the Semantic Cybersecurity Brief, our fortnightly podcast where we discuss all things cybersecurity. I'm Dick O'Brien and joining me today are Semantic Threat Researchers Piotr Krutschuk and Vikram Thakur. This week's podcast is a little bit out of the ordinary because we're going to devote the entire episode to one topic. That's because last week, we at Semantic's Threat Hunter team published a major new piece of research revealing the existence of Daxin, an espionage tool that is being used by attackers linked to China. In our opinion, Daxin is the most advanced piece of malware we've ever seen used by Chinese actors. And today, we're hoping to tell you a little bit more about Daxin and how it's being used and maybe provide some insights into how this investigation unfolded. I'm going to turn over to you first, Piotr, because you're the guy who did all of the analysis work in Daxin, and a lot of our understanding of the significance of Daxin stems from your work. So I guess my first question is, I mean, I know you analyze a lot of malware. At what point did it become obvious to you that you were dealing with something out of the ordinary with Daxin?
So there was no single thing on single point in time. There was number of actual whole set of indicators that Daxin is not usual, so I cannot really point, oh, this is the specific one. What I can say is that even before we started, before I started to reverse engineer Daxin driver, something stood out, and one of those where and how attackers use Daxin. So first, from what we could see, Daxin use was rather limited, where we observed only a very small set of victims over the recent years. And looking at the specific victims, we could make certain conclusions about attackers' motivations. Second, in one particular case, we could see how persistent were the attackers with their attempts to deploy what we believe is Daxin. This case was very briefly mentioned in our initial blog about Daxin, so let me provide a bit more details. The activity is from July 2020, where we noticed an attempt to deploy a suspicious driver. What was interesting is that after the first failed attempt, the attacker decided to retry with what looked like a variant of the same driver. However, it seems that it was not an easy thing to do for the attackers, because it took them almost 4 hours before they were ready to retry. Then, after the second failed attempt, we could observe another significant delay before the attackers decided to switch to different malware. So overall, it looked as if there was something special about the driver where we suspect is Daxin, such that attackers preferred it over this other malware. And then later, once I started to reverse engineer the driver, more things started to pop up. What I mean by reverse engineering is essentially to take apart the driver binary and look at the machine code. The usual process is to split the code into individual functions and then try to identify the functions that are most important, interesting, and figure out the purpose of those functions. So you can think of solving a jigsaw puzzle. And then even after you get a few pieces together, you can get some idea about specific features. So I think that one of those important features that emerged quite early when reverse engineering was about what we describe under key exchange in the blog. And this is about how Daxin constructs encryption keys for its communication. And the protocol requires two communication endpoints to follow complementary steps that are different for each peer. And what caught my attention was that Daxin implemented both sides of the protocol. So, you know, conclusion was that perhaps two infected machines could communicate with each other. And because this is rather unusual, rare, I essentially focused on exploring any related functionality. So this leads to how attackers can set up across connectivity across multiple machines infected with Daxin to Daxin on the victim network. And you know, since Daxin developers clearly optimized for such use case, it seemed like it was important for the operators. So I guess this is like one of the main moments.
Yeah, and one of the things I'm curious about is Daxin is a Windows driver, And what I was told was, that's not common to see with malware these days. Could you maybe explain to us why an attacker would develop it as a driver and why it's something we don't see a lot of?
Yes, you are correct. The main advantage of using the drivers is that they give full control over what happens on the affected computer. And in case of Daxin, it allows to monitor and intercept any TCP/IP communication on the affected computer. This happens from under the legitimate Windows TCP/IP stack. So it is generic. What I mean is that it may work for any network services running on the infected computer. And additionally, any network connections maintained by Daxin itself are somehow hidden from common tools that may just interact with the legitimate TCP/IP stack of Windows. To the second part of your question, so I could think of two main reasons why we don't see too many backdoors that are developed in form of drivers nowadays. The first reason is that amount of effort required and the associated cost is higher comparing with any user mode malware. So it may be more economical for the malware developers to invest into simpler malware that just runs in user mode. At least in cases where the attackers are able to achieve their goals, it's just simpler to use the user mode backdoors. Another reason why drivers may not be that common is that in case of 64-bit Windows, drivers must be signed in order to load. And this means extra burden for the attackers, while defenders could try to inspect the signatures of the files to identify anything that could be potentially suspicious.
Okay, that's really interesting. I mean, I guess lots of advantages of it being a driver, but it is difficult to do and potentially costly to do. And that probably gives us another insight on the attackers behind Daxin, because it indicates that, I guess, the skill and resources they have at their fingertips. There's lots of interesting aspects of the malware from reading our first blog, and I know we published some follow-up analysis blogs this week. But I guess for me, two things in particular jumped out. The first thing is that we describe Daxin as having the ability to keep a low profile because it doesn't start its own network services, and instead it hijacks communication to legitimate services. Could you maybe explain a bit more about how that works?
Sure. So I think the best way to explain it is maybe to give some example. Of course, it's like specific example you can generalize, but just to start. So let's say that we have two computers on the network and they are configured to communicate for some legitimate reasons. One example could be where you have a web server that is reachable from internet, and then there is another computer that runs some backend service that is used by this web server. So let's assume that there is a TCP client running somewhere on this web server that needs to connect to the backend service on the intranet for some legitimate purposes. The best practice for such setup is to isolate as much as possible the web server from the intranet. So, you cannot just start arbitrary connections and you are limited to what you can talk with. So now in case if both machines are infected with Daxin, what attackers could do is they could instruct the Daxin malware running on the web server to start their own connection to the legitimate service, the same backend service on the intranet that is used by the legitimate TCP client. And then this connection is accepted by the backend service, the same as if it would be like a legitimate connection from your web server. However, what happens next is that the Daxin running on the web server sends the magic sequence over this TCP/IP connection, and this sequence is then intercepted by the Daxin running on the backend machine. So what happens is that the Daxin running on the backend essentially disconnects this TCP connection from the backend service and just uses it for its own communication purposes, which means that for the defenders it looks like there is some legitimate client or something that looks like a legitimate client connecting to legitimate service on the intranet.
Okay, so if I understand that correctly, that means that, say, for somebody who's monitoring the traffic on the network, they're not really going to see anything unusual there. It's business as usual, per se. And is that why Daxin can be so stealthy in its communications?
Yes, this is correct. So, unless you start to look into actual bytes that are sent over this connection, you are rather unlikely to distinguish between connectivity from Daxin from connectivity from your usual client.
Okay. I think that's one of the things. All right, I thought that was remarkable about this malware, because often the things that raise red flags about malware is the fact that they need to communicate, and if you can hide that, you've got a lot of benefits there. The second thing I mentioned that seemed important to me was I think I'm describing correctly, the ability to create peer-to-peer connections between different computers that have been infected with Daxin, and thus allowing the attackers to go deep into secured environments. Could you tell us more about that?
Yes, so this was one of the surprising bits. It's not uncommon to see that attackers need to make multiple jumps over the network. So maybe they start from some DMZ machine, and then they need to jump over different hosts over the network. But usually, the tools that they are using, they require for each of those hops to be a separate step. So maybe you just need to click somewhere and say, okay, this machine is the next one, and then you need to go to the next one, etc., until you reach the place where you need to be or where you want to be. So what is unusual about Daxin is that this was essentially optimized. So what happens is that you just, as an attacker, you just issue a single command, and this command gives a list of all the hops that are required to be made in order to reach the destination. So to me, it means that this was important for them to do. I don't think they would be bothering to implement such functionality unless this is something that will be common case or something that they were required to implement by the users or the operators, I should say. So this is really something that once I discovered it, it was standing out. Of course, there are some other malware that can do things like this. For example, like Regin, as we mentioned in the blog, where they can essentially configure some sort of routing rules, and then malware can communicate over multiple hops to reach the attack the CNC, the attackers. So this is something really, really unusual, and I would say it was one of the things that I didn't expect until almost the very end of my analysis of the malware.
Yeah, I mean, the way you describe it there, it's sort of, the efforts they have to go to implement that functionality suggests how important it is to them. You mentioned Regin there, and I know we made some comparison to it in our report. And I guess it prompts the next question, which is, we said this is maybe the most advanced piece of Chinese malware we've seen to date. How does it compare to malware that you've seen that have been developed by other state-sponsored actors? How does it stack up?
So essentially, there is still a big gap between what you can see from Five Eyes comparing with what you can see from China. But I think it's mostly because of the tactics used. So I believe that Chinese actors tend to use things that are cheap to develop, and they don't really have to be very careful about where they deploy and how they use it. They can essentially afford to lose those things. Once they lose it, they can come up with the next one. And, you know, it's like, if it's easy to write, it's easy to recycle. So, you know, this is usual practice. In case of most of the Western, of the malware attributed to the Western intelligence, you could see that they are usually developed in some sort of like proper process. So, you know, like it almost looks like, you know, contractors doing some proper software development works, and then you have operators that follows orders and follows procedures. So, you know, like it means that it's more practical for the Western intelligence to develop things that are complex, and you know, they can they know that they can rely on the operators to be careful about how the things are deployed. And you know, it's slightly different in China, I would guess, usually, where you probably see more like a small contractors. At least this is my impression. Like maybe you have common small contractors that develop their own small bits and pieces, and then use them as long as they can. And then once they get exposed, they just move to another malware. And you know, so comparing Daxin with Western malware, it looks like a step up. They invested significant amount of time comparing with what they usually do, which means that probably they were more careful about where they deploy, but it's still like it's way, way behind in terms of complexity and in terms of extensibility.
Okay, that's a interesting explanation, all right, that it's not just, I guess, all about technical capabilities. It's also about the tactics you choose to deploy. Finally, could you maybe give us an idea about how long it takes to analyze a tool like this? Because I've read your report on it, and it's pretty extensive. But I was always interested to find out of how many hours or days did it take to thoroughly analyze Daxin.
So your question about completely analyze. So it really depends. In case of Daxin, it's relatively compact. Yeah. So, you know, like it's not huge amount of time, it's still significant. But I can say that it really depends on the requirements. So, you know, just to figure out the basic functionality, it's almost straightforward. You essentially need to run it, collect some information, and then, you know, a few hours, you can get basic idea about the most basic functionality. But then if you try to analyze a bit deeper, try to understand how it communicates with other bits and pieces, try to analyze this peer-to-peer communication, try to write, client, because at the end I had like a client that can talk their protocol and they can issue instructions. So to get this level of understanding, I think it's fair to say like 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks of work. To get like a full understanding of all those important bits and pieces. And it's still like way, way lower than, let's say, comparing with Daxin, with Regin, you could probably spend, let's say, 2 or 3 months to get basic understanding, mostly because of the amount of extensions that are available. Like Regin comes together with a huge number of modules. So, you know, it drives the effort.
Okay, thanks, Piotr.
No problem.
Okay, let's turn to you, Vikram, because your role in this investigation was, I think you were involved in investigations of attacks involving Daxin, but you were also involved in talking to some of the victims that we discovered. But maybe first of all, could you elaborate a little bit more on the types of organizations that Daxin was used against?
Yeah, absolutely, Nick. What we saw were only a small volume of impacted organizations, or should I say targeted organizations over the past decade, but a vast, vast majority of these organizations were part of governments. Not Western governments, but other governments which might be of strategic interest to China, and a small remaining portion of the victim or targeted organizations out here were somehow affiliated to governments. I mean, they could have been in the IT sector. In some cases, they were part of the energy vertical, but pretty close to affiliation with local governments in those countries.
Okay. And you mentioned China there, and I know we pretty categorically state that this is a Chinese tool. Could you maybe tell us why we think that this is linked to China?
So there are at least a couple of things, maybe even more. But the first being that in a very small set of attacks that were performed by the actor behind Daxin, we found that they attempted to install Daxin in a victim network, but had some trouble doing so. And at the end, they resorted to installing yet another publicly talked about backdoor that is that's called OwlProxy. And publicly, OwlProxy has been attributed to an actor operating out of China. So that's one thing. We also have some evidence on the side which talks about code which has been used within Daxin that has been authored by actors operating out of China and sharing some of that code in Chinese forums. So a combination of these two makes us think that this is a work of art by some Chinese actor.
Yeah, and I guess combined with the fact that a lot of the targets you mentioned might be of a strategic interest to China, it's probably enough to make an attribution. One thing you said earlier on was that it had been used very infrequently. So I guess the obvious question is that, you know, if this is a super advanced tool, why do they roll it out so rarely?
Ah, that is that's an interesting point. So you see, there's a bit of a history that's sort of required out here. So for years and maybe a couple of decades, the security industry has been tracking malware coming out of actors operating out of China. And in almost all the cases, the malware itself was sort of designed for a more smash and grab type attack campaign, where the malware gets inside a network and the attacker doesn't care about the amount of noise that he's generating, but just tries to grab whatever intellectual property or business sensitive documents that they can and exfiltrate them away to themselves. So it's very, very tactical thinking out there where, hey, you get into a network and within a few hours or maximum of a few days, you're out of there. That's in sort of the first piece of malware that we have seen coming out of an actor in China, where it is the complete opposite from a strategy standpoint. Daxin was designed to be used against strategic interests of the possibly the country, but for two real purposes. One, extend the amount of time that Daxin can be used and be present inside a particular targeted network, because the point was more around espionage rather than just stealing some information from that network. And to achieve that is number two, which is increase the level of stealth, where you're not even starting any new services, new ports, you're not doing anything of that sort. So Daxin was truly designed as a long-term strategic campaign tool by these actors. And that is the reason why they keep the volume of attacks extremely low, maybe just two, maximum three organizations in a given year, just so that they don't get detected and this tool can stay alive for a long period of time. And it sort of worked because we have evidence of its existence for over a decade. So whatever their initial plan and strategy was, it worked for a very long time.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. I mean, every time you deploy a tool, there is a greater than zero chance it'll be discovered. But 10 years, I guess they may kind of look at that as a good return on investment before it was discovered. I know that something you were very heavily involved was, I guess, you know, after we kind of got a picture of what Daxin was and who it was being used against, you know, we needed to talk to some of the organizations that were affected by Daxin attacks. What was involved in that?
So this was obviously a little tricky because we started out with a list of organizations that had gotten targeted in the past. So it's always tricky to reach out to an organization and say, hey, we believe that your network may have been compromised a couple of years ago, or in some cases even longer, because they don't really know what to do about it. And it's really just a question of informing them so that they can take a look at their infrastructure, they can understand the threat, and then they can make a decision on whether the architecture of their network needs any changes or not. So we did that in a number of cases, and then we reached a stage where we were able to see victims of Daxin outside of the footprint of Broadcom products. So those were victims who were actually impacted at that very moment. So let's say late in December of 2021, early January, as well as in February, we found victims. And again, these, in some cases, these were governments. In some cases, they were other organizations. And getting in touch with them was not easy. You give them a cold call and they don't really believe who you are, and they think it's some sort of a phishing attack, and they don't respond, which is, you know, fair to them as well. So in these cases, what we did was we reached out to our partners in CISA and DHS in the United States in the hopes that maybe CISA and DHS might have partners in the Department of State who might be able to contact the local embassies that the United States has in these countries and get us in touch with some of these people. And we thought it was worth it just because these are relatively smaller countries in some cases, and they don't necessarily have the budgets for cyber defense against an actor of this caliber. And we wanted to do the right thing. It was a surprise to us, but it was a welcome surprise that CISA took it upon themselves to get us in touch with these foreign governments. And literally, like within 48 hours of our original email to DHS and CISA, we were on a virtual call with the first of these governments. And then we walked them through the whole process of finding the malware, remediation, and ultimately cleanup of their network. So, which was interesting, and it comes with its own challenges because in some cases, Daxin was sitting on an Exchange server, which is a mail server. Mm-hmm. So you can't really write an email about their email server being compromised, and it brought its own little challenges. But it was interesting, and our partnership with CISA and DHS really, really worked out over there, and it's it sort of set a precedent even for them at this point.
Yeah, I mean, I know it's kind of a new departure for us, but it is a nice example of how maybe governments and vendors like ourselves can collaborate and make the best of each other's strengths.
I truly believe that. I mean, you know, for decades, we've been talking about public-private partnership. And sure, you know, it comes in different flavors, but this is a real example of public-private partnership where we were able to bring in the technical expertise while the government was able to bring in the power of their connections and the ability to get somebody else on the phone call when we're trying to help them out. So it was a very satisfying experience.
Okay, thanks for talking to us, Vikram. I think we'll wrap it up there. That's about all we have time for this week. If you've been enjoying our podcast, don't forget to subscribe to avoid missing out on all of our future episodes. And you can also follow us on Twitter at Threat Intel. If you'd like to read our latest research, check out our blog, which can be found at semantic-enterprise-blogs.security.com/blogs/threat-intelligence. We'll be back again in 2 weeks' time, but until then, thank you and goodbye.